This might be the best quarterback draft class in years, and we have huge franchises like Chicago, New England, and Washington with a ton on the line. My name is Craig Horlbeck, and I host the Ringer NFL Draft Show with Danny Kelly, Ben Solak, and Danny Heifetz. We cover trades, free agency, the draft, obviously, everything. We'll tell you all about which quarterbacks are going to be good, which quarterbacks are going to be bad, like Kenny Pickett, and if there's a diamond in the rough, like Brock Purdy. Follow us at the Ringer NFL Draft Show on Spotify.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. April showers bring a loaded sports calendar, and FanDuel is the place to bet on it all. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and get paid instantly when you win. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett, recording late after the Celtics escaped with a win over the Bucks that got a little bit too close for comfort. We'll get into that in just a second here. Also got to chat with my buddy John Jastrzemski. JJ, of course, you know him from New York, New York, East Coast bias, wise guys on FanDuel TV. So he's going to join us. I figured this is the one time of the year we can talk college basketball, right? So we got into our favorite picks in each region, some good value picks, and we went through a couple of games that we like in the first round of the tournament. So had a ton of fun doing that with JJ. So we'll get you that in just a little bit. But before that, I do want to get into the Celtics because, man, you had to sweat that game out. We're getting ready to talk about sweating out games in the tournament. We certainly were sweating this one out from a Celtics perspective because they let go of the rope in the fourth quarter. And I don't want to come on here and do a whole thing where I'm complaining about the Celtics. I'm really not. That was just a game that we've seen this recently with the Celtics against the Cavaliers, where they just sort of let go of the rope. And the good thing about this game is they actually won the game last time against the Cavaliers. Of course, they lost that one. Thank you very much to Dean Wade. But one of the things that stuck out to me is the Bucks go on that 22-6 run and ended up being a 25-6 run in the fourth quarter. And the way that it got to that point, it was a zone that the Bucks threw at the Celtics. And it just felt like, for whatever reason, whether the Celtics just felt like, hey, we're easily going to win this game, whatever it wasn't like an impressive zone. The Bucks don't have a good zone. And a lot of times teams do have good zones, like Miami. They can throw out a lot of different things from a zone perspective, but the Bucks don't have a good zone. It was not very effective. It's just the Celtics were settling for shots. I mean, you can easily break down that zone. The Celtics, and that was sort of a sign based on what the Celtics have been doing the whole game through the first three quarters. That was a sign from the Bucks, hey, we're going to try anything here. We're basically surrendering the fact that we cannot guard you man-to-man, so let's go to a zone. So I thought the Celtics really let the Bucks off the hook in terms of they stopped executing and running good offense when the Bucks put that zone there. It sort of felt like they were just like, hey, we hit a couple of threes, we'll win this game relatively easily. And this is not a three discussion, believe me. It just felt like they settled for way too many easy shots when they could have easily dissected that Bucks zone. But anyway, so that was my big takeaway from what was going on in the fourth quarter. It was a zone that they should have been better against. But I would also point out it's a 22-6 run, and then Jaylen gets to the free throw line. He misses a pair of free throws. After that, Portis hits a three. And one thing to look out for here with Jaylen Brown, this has been an issue with Jaylen. And look, I've told you, I told you earlier, right after the All-Star break, games after the All-Star break, that Jaylen's playing his best basketball of his career post-All-Star break. But one thing that is still going on, and we saw it in the Denver game as well, Jaylen entered the night 34 of 51, which is 66.7%, from the free throw line in the fourth quarter. 66.7%, and he, of course, misses the pair there. So that's just something to keep in the back of your head, because we've seen Jalen in the past miss on critical free throws. That was another example of that tonight where he missed a pair. Portis goes down the other way, hits the three, as we mentioned. Okay, so 2 minutes left in the game. Tatum spreads the floor. He drives. He gets to the lane on Beasley. Beasley is a terrible defender. He hits both. He makes it 112-107 after the lead was cut down to three. Okay, after that, Tatum gets Beasley on him again, goes right by him, scores, makes it 114-107. Then they run a quick hitter to Damian Lillard. Lillard makes it 114-109. Then you have an isolation Tatum again on Beasley. He misses it, but Porzingis gets the rebound, that massive dunk. He's mean mugging everybody, makes it 116-109. At that particular point in time, you think the game is over. Lillard then hits a three to make it 116-112. And then Derek White, a rare mistake for Derek White, he throws an alley-oop looking for Porzingis. It gets blocked, and essentially it looks like a missed floater, but I believe it was essentially, or I should say, it is an alley-oop he's throwing to Porzingis. It gets deflected, goes out of bounds. So the Celtics have 5 seconds left on the shot clock. White gets the ball back. He misses a floater. So he had the bad pass to Porzingis, and then he missed the floater. Rarely does Derek White make mistakes late in the game. He did there, and then it's 116-112. Portis hits a floater, and Derek White actually fouls him. So it's an and one, so it's cut to 116-114. So a rare case where you see Derek White make mistakes on both the offensive end and the defensive end, basically on the same sequence. After that, Jaylen Brown posts up Malik Beasley, elbow extended, Beasley with an idiotic foul, where Jalen is essentially at the three-point line. And instead of making the Celtics try to score on you, he fouls them. They're in the bonus. Jalen, to his credit, after missing those free throws, it was nice to see him hit those free throws, makes it 118-114. And then late in the game, they run a play for Lillard where they're down four. I don't know why they're not going for a three there. They go for the quick two. Jalen, a nice contest on Lillard. Lillard misses a floater-type shot off the backboard. And that basically ends the game. So a couple of thoughts, and I just wanted to run through what was going down the stretch of the game for a couple of reasons. So first, I want to say this. I love that Tatum stepped up and he finished the game for the Celtics. He made those critical plays in the fourth quarter, and part of it is he has a bad defender in Beasley on him, so he does have a matchup advantage there. So they press that button. Okay, we're going after Beasley. Tatum is going to score him at will, and he did. But so I don't want to sound like I'm complaining too much, but I would like some variety late in the game, because of course the Porzingis play is a huge play in the game that Tatum misses, but you can't complain when you have a result like that, right? Where the late game execution has been questioned from Celtics fans, the media, etc., and Tatum comes through. So you first of all, you have to give Tatum credit, because yes, it's an easy matchup. He took advantage, he executed, but he deserves credit for that executing late in the game. But I still want to see more to this offense late in games than Tatum isos, because that's what we saw down the stretch of the game. It was basically just, hey, Beasley's on Tatum, let's go iso ball, because we've seen too many times down the stretch in some of these games, they just feel so good about the Tatum matchup that they ignore everything else they're doing. And I did feel like late in the game tonight, that was an instance where they didn't have much variety. Now, give Tatum credit. Like I'm saying, give Tatum a ton of credit, but I just felt like that offense, Beasley sucks on defense, I get all that, but maybe I'm asking too much. I just want more variety late in the games than just spread the court, Tatum isolations. He's clearly capable of doing it, like we saw on multiple occasions tonight, but I would just like to see better process down the stretch of those games. Okay, now obviously not a good sign being up 21 in the fourth and that lead gets cut down to two. They were outscored 36-21 in the fourth quarter. So that's not great. I do like the fact that they actually found a way to come up with critical baskets late in this game. And I keep repeating this. I don't want to sound too negative, but the fourth quarter, not much fun. But watching this game, one thing that stuck out to me is, and that is a sense of maturity, right? Where you blow the game against the Cavs, where you blow the big lead. This one, at least you finish it. So I do give the Celtics a ton of credit for that. And I want to be abundantly clear, this is still the best team in the NBA. At least record-wise, we've had the conversation about the Nuggets. The team is playing unbelievable basketball. They had a bad quarter. Totally acknowledge all that. But the one thing I will say is, if you look at this game tonight, I thought Middleton played really well for them. He had 22 on 8 of 11 shooting. He had 6 assists, and he made some difficult shots. Lillard goes 11 of 21, but 6 of 10 on threes. So he goes for 32 and 6. And Portis had 24 and 15. They had trouble with Portis in this game as well. So, look, I believe the Celtics will defend better, especially than the way they did in the fourth quarter of this game, because I thought for the most part they played well for three quarters, and there's just one quarter they played poorly. But the thing that dawned on me during this game is it does feel like we've gone through this whole idea of, hey, who's the biggest competition to the Celtics in the Eastern Conference? And at different times during the season, it felt like a different team. I do think it's now the Bucks again, because you look at that Lillard, Giannis, Lopez, Middleton lineup, because obviously no Giannis tonight. That four-man unit, 584 minutes, a 124.6 offensive rating, a 108.2 defensive rating, so a plus 16.4 net rating. That lineup has been dominant, and Middleton, he's clearly not a great defender anymore. We know that Lillard is just somebody that you can take advantage of, which the Celtics did early in this game, and they kind of went away from that. But nonetheless, like, two of those guys are bad defenders. But the point being is that four-man unit has been pretty consistent for the Bucks all season long. And not having Giannis in there tonight, you think about what Giannis does for that team. And it does kind of concern you that Giannis is now dealing with all these injuries, where it was an Achilles situation, now it's a hamstring thing. And it wasn't a fake thing, obviously, because Giannis didn't play on Sunday in that game against the Suns. So he would have had plenty of time to rest, if you will, if it was just a rest situation. So clearly something's going on with Giannis here, where he keeps having these nagging injuries. But so Giannis, you look at it on the season, 20 points in the paint, which is first in the NBA. Zion is second at 17.6. The team had just 38 points in the paint. And the Bucks are not a high paint scoring team to begin with. They averaged just 47.6, which is 24th. So they had 38 tonight, and you usually get 20 from Giannis, right? So that's obviously missing. The Celtics, by the way, only had 28 points in the paint in this game. No team itself of 45.3. The Celtics were post All-Star break. Their points in the paint were way up. It's gone down in the past few games. It's tough to complain because they're blowing teams out. One thing though, Jaylen in the paint was just 2 of 8. Just if you look at it, just what? 4 points in the paint for Jaylen, which is something that he's been really good at. Post All-Star break, he's at 15 points per game in the paint. We've alluded to that a couple of times, which is 6 in the NBA, and just 2 of 8 tonight in the paint. So on the Celtics side, you could say, okay, Jaylen just had an off night shooting, which he did. And then you look at fast break points. Giannis is number one in the NBA at 5.4. The team had just 4 tonight. So that's another thing that the Bucks were missing, that guy that can push the ball in transition. And if you look at the makes less than 5 feet from the basket, he's at 9.3 per game, which is by far first in the NBA. Zion's at 7.6. So all this stuff they did tonight, hitting difficult shots with Middleton, with Dame, then you add that battering ram that is Giannis into the paint, which makes a total difference. So this is part of the whole conclusion, where you have a guy that's won two MVPs. He's not even in the game tonight, and the Bucks are in this one because Lillard's making crazy shots, Middleton's making crazy shots, and we know both of those guys are capable of doing that at a high level. Middleton did it throughout a postseason run a couple of years ago. Now, I know the Celtics are without Drew, but I think you would take the trade-off of not having Drew and them not having Giannis, right? And the other thing I just mentioned with Doc, they're now 12-11 with Doc, but the defensive rating, rather, 113.5 prior to tonight with Doc, which is 14th in the NBA. It was at 116.3 prior to Doc, which was 19th. And if you look at it, they've just cleaned up some things. So the Bucks defense with Doc, they're allowing 11.7 fast break points per game, third in the NBA. Pre-Doc, that number is 14.8, 22nd. You look at the points in the paint, Celtics, of course, very low tonight, as we mentioned. 47.2 with Doc, 6th in the NBA. 53.7 without Doc, 24th. So they're just doing the little things better with Doc, and they have a competent coach now that they didn't have before. Now, the one thing I will say, Lillard made some fucking crazy shots tonight. Can you do that over the course of a 7-game series? Like, Lillard's numbers on the season, his isolation game, 0.93 points per possession, 51st percentile. Last year, that number was at 1.17, which was 91st percentile. That is a significant drop-off. Then you look at the twos. Lillard on twos this season, 49.5%, 116th out of 140 qualifiers. Last year, he was at 57.4%. So a significant drop-off there. And even in this game tonight, where he's hitting all those crazy threes, he's just 5'11 on two-point shots. Now, they put Jaylen on him, the size bothered him at times, but it's just he's hitting crazy threes. So if you think about it throughout the course of a series, I don't trust Lillard to be able to score at the level he did in this game tonight. I thought he just hit some crazy threes. And Lillard's had his postseason moments. He's also had some really bad postseason series as well. But overall, you would take the Celtics to beat the Bucks in the series. But I just think when we're looking at the biggest competition to the Celtics, having Giannis, having to deal with him throughout a seven-game series, and I would have liked to see the Celtics match up with Giannis again post-trading deadline and all that, because now we're not going to see it. They had that one blowout game recently, which you really can't put too much stock into that one. And the first matchup in the season was without Doc Rivers as well. So it's just, it's two totally different teams. I wanted to see that matchup. We get robbed of that. But I just look at the other teams in the East, if you're juxtaposing the Bucks to them, and why I think the Bucks are the biggest competition, because they have the best player, arguably, in the Eastern Conference, in Giannis, a guy that's won a championship, with Lillard, who can hit big shots, even if I don't trust it over a series, and with Middleton, who looks a little bit healthier now, and Portis has played unbelievable basketball post-All-Star break. If you look at the Knicks, and by the way, let me mention this real quick. It is going to be so annoying to play these guys in a series. Portis is annoying. Beverly is so annoying. And Giannis's brother is so annoying as well, right? I mean, the guy doesn't even play and he's up on the bench all the time. He's just annoying. But you look at the Knicks, right? So OG is now going to miss more time. OG Anunoby, his elbow's flaring up. He just had elbow surgery and his elbow's flaring up. That's not good. Maybe he came back too soon. You look at the numbers with OG on the court. They're outscoring teams by 24.6 points per 100 in his 598 minutes. They're 15-2 with him on the court. They have the second highest plus minus, or he has the second highest plus minus on the team in just 17 games. Okay. So the fact that he's already dealing with this elbow situation again would be concerning, because that guy's been really good for them. And Julius Randle, we don't know if he's going to come back, right? He's been dealing with, they said he wasn't ready. He was going to be ready for contact. Then he wasn't ready for contact. They need his playmaking. He's averaging 5 assists per game, second on the team. The offensive rating with him on the court, 121.4, second, 113.5 off, which would be 20th. They need his physicality, and he's dealing with a shoulder situation. You just don't trust the health of the Knicks going forward. That's why clearly you put the Bucks ahead of the Knicks right now. You look at the Cavaliers. Mitchell just had surgery on his nose. He's going to be reevaluated in a week. He got hit in the nose the other night, and he had that PRP injection on his knee. Brian Windhorst recently said that that injection did not accomplish what it needed to. He has a severe case of tendonitis. So this is a guy that's averaging 27.4 and 6.1, but he probably is not going to be healthy based on what we're finding out now about the knee situation. And of course, he's going to come off a nose injury as well, less severe than the knee thing. The 76ers, Embiid, coming back from a meniscus injury if he comes back. Nick Nurse said the other day he's confident, but this is a guy that's 7 feet, 280 pounds. He's a guy that has struggled with staying in shape to begin with. How good is he going to be when he comes back? Then you look at Orlando. The Magic are playing awesome basketball right now. Awesome. I gave out their over win total on East Coast Bias when we're at the All-Star break, because they had one of the easiest schedules in the NBA. They're the best team against the spread in the entire NBA. They beat the shit out of bad teams. But the last two games the Celtics played against Orlando, 114-97, 128-111. And look, Suggs is really shooting the ball well post-All-Star break, but I just don't think they have the offense to keep up with the Celtics. Then you look at the Pacers, 25th in defense. 25th in defense, okay? They're not going to be able to stop the Celtics in a series. Then you think about the Heat. They had lost 6 of 7 prior to tonight. They're 24th in offense. Now, you look at them on the season, they're 20th in made threes. It is interesting, Bam, the last four games that he played in, didn't play in this game tonight, had hit a three in all of them. So he's barely taken any, but I don't think their three-point total is going to go up because Bam is taking a couple of threes now. But you look at Martin, he's averaging 10.6 points per game. He averaged 19.3 in that series against the Celtics last season, and he had three 20-point games. He shot 48.9% on threes. In the finals, he averaged 7.4 and shot 33.3% from deep. He turned into a different player in the finals, and this year, 10.6 points per game. So the Heat, and I know this is going to sound crazy because they're the Heat, they don't scare me nearly as much as they did a year ago. I just don't think from a talent perspective, they're on the same level as the Celtics. And I know you could say that in previous years, but this Celtics team does feel different than the one from last year. I think we'd all agree on that. So that's why I just come back to the conclusion. I believe that right now, the biggest threat to the Celtics in the East, we all thought it before the season, it's the Milwaukee Bucks. That's the team that scares me the most. The fact that they can steal a couple of games, like in those clutch situations, they could steal a game Lillard hits a crazy shot. Middleton hits a couple of shots. Giannis wears you down as the series goes on. That's the team that would scare me the most right now in the East. And at different times this year, I thought it was the Heat. I thought it was the Knicks. Early on, the first time they lost to the Magic, I'm like, oh, I really don't want to see the Magic in a series. But to me right now, it's the Bucks. Okay, one thing I wanted to mention, though, awesome Pritchard game. He made this game fun in the first half. I thought it was going to be a blowout, and Pritchard made this game fun in the first half when I did think it was going to be a blowout. 19 points, 5 of 8 from deep. So he hits a three ball over Lillard relatively early in this game. It made it 33-28. And then Beverly scores, and he gives Pritchard the two small. And then Pritchard just went nuts. I loved it. It's like Beverly got him fired up. He hits a three, starts talking shit to Beverly, made it 38-30. Drove by Connaughton, made it 40-32. Then he put Gallinari on skates, hit a step back to make it 45-34. And then he drove, hit a nice little mid-ranger. And you look at him now in the season, like he had a nice three where he pushed the ball in transition, relocated, got the ball back, hit a three, made it 56-38. And then he flew in, got an offensive rebound on Lopez, which was just great to see. I mean, at that point, the Celtics were up, what, 18 points. They'd later give the lead back, but that was awesome to see. And the crowd got into it. So I thought Pritchard's energy, his energy's always awesome, but I thought it was on a different level tonight because of the whole interaction with Beverly. So thank Patrick Beverly for that awesome Pritchard game. And just some things on the season. He's now at 4.1 assist to turnover ratio, ninth in the NBA. His rebounds per 36 are at 5.5. That's the same as Brandon Ingram, a small forward, and Anthony Edwards. The guy rebounds like crazy. He's 38.3% on threes. You look at the Celtics via cleaning the glass, a 125.4 offensive rating with him on the court, ninth in the NBA, 3.5 points better per 100 possessions, 80th percentile. So yeah, that on-court number is good for a lot of Celtics, but the increase is different than a lot of other guys on this team. And the thing that's interesting to me, I've alluded to the fact that he goes after all these rebounds. The Celtics are, in terms of their offensive rebounding percentage, it's 32.4% with Pritchard on the court, which is in the 90th percentile, and it increases by 9.1 percentage points with him on the court. That's in the 99th percentile. So just to put that into context, 32.4% offensive rebounding percentage with Pritchard on the court, that's the same as the Knicks who lead the league. They're at 23.3% with him off the court. Only two teams are south of that. And he is the guy making an impact at the point guard position. He's just got a knack for, even if he doesn't get the offensive rebound, he puts pressure on the defenders and somebody else on the Celtics will get the offensive rebound. So nice Pritchard game. Really nice Pritchard game. I loved it. White had the foul trouble early on, still finished with, what, 23. He had four threes, three big ones late in the game. He had eight assists. And he had a great block on Portis, where it's 33-28 when he made it. Awesome, awesome block on Portis, and he continues to do this. And then I thought he hit some big threes late in the game, where he had a wing three to give the Celtics, what, a 13-point lead again after it had been cut to a 10-point game. It was a 12-0 Bucks run at that point. He hits a three, makes it 107-94. Then he hit a wing three when it was cut to 10 again, made it 110-97. Now, eventually, the Celtics gave back that lead, but those are big threes by White at that point. Really, the only points they were really scoring when the Bucks had that zone on. You look at White on the season entering tonight, 38 of 86 on threes in the fourth quarter, 44.2%. So I mentioned earlier, he made a couple of mistakes late in the game, but it does feel like every time he takes a three in the fourth quarter, you feel pretty good about the shot selection and the shot going in. Jalen, we mentioned the concerns about the late free throws. Thought he had a nice stretch in the third quarter, finished with the 21 points. I do like the fact that he started on Lillard, and I do wonder if part of the inconsistency tonight with Jalen's offense was partly because he had such a big assignment on the defensive end. But if you look at him in terms of what he did in that third quarter stretch, Tatum gets a rebound, gives it to Jalen. Jalen pushes, pull up 21-footer on Beverly, makes it 67-54. He had another pull-up mid-ranger. Three ball to make it 76-68 after the Bucks had hit, what, four threes essentially to open up that third quarter. Drove by Middleton, which he didn't have a lot of space. Kind of faked like he was going to take a step back. Blew by Middleton. Finished with his left, made it 78-68. And then he had a nice play where the defense started to react to Jalen because he was starting to get it going there. Took two with them. Behind the back pass to Al. Al hit a top of the corner three to make, or top of the key three to make it 84-70. You do wonder if some of the issues from the offense, from the paint numbers and all that that I referenced earlier. I'm not concerned about Jalen. This guy's playing phenomenal basketball. I do wonder if some of that was fatigue from the Lillard matchup. That's a lot to do to chase Lillard around the way that he was. Porzingis, 0 of 5 from deep, had 17 points. Did get to the line 6 times, which is a good thing. You'll love to see that. We know he's eventually going to shoot the ball better from 3 because he's been doing it most of the season. A couple of things where I thought like they pressed the cheat code button. They got Beasley switched on him, hit a jumper over Beasley. Got Lillard switched on him, hit a jumper over Lillard. He had a sick pass to Tatum, by the way, where Tatum got to the free throw line. And then a sick pass to Derek White out of a double where he hit a 3. And then he had that nice fake handoff and went around Lopez and didn't dunk on him, but sort of dunked around him. And then he had Beverly matched up on him in the post, and he was able to score on that. So that's a big thing for the Celtics. It's just, even though he didn't shoot the ball well, they got so many mismatches with him on the court that he certainly took advantage of in this game. So even if he wasn't shooting the ball well, he provided really good stuff for the Celtics on the offensive end. And then one interesting coaching note in this game, just 9 minutes for Cornette and 14 for Tillman. And this is not a critique of Mazzulla whatsoever. I'm just pointing this out because it feels like in a potential Bucks series, we're not going to see a lot of Cornette because of the Lillard factor. Because at points, they were setting the screen really high, and I don't think they want Cornette on the, this is just what I took away from the minutes. I don't think they want Cornette on the court. I think that's why they went with Tillman there and not Cornette, because Cornette does a lot of things well. He's been unbelievable post All-Star break. I've given him a ton of compliments. I talked about the second chance points because of Cornette, the pick and roll numbers with Cornette, the way that he's able to generate screen assists. Like, he's done a lot of good things. I just feel like they don't like this matchup, and that's part of the reason you bring in a guy like Tillman for a specific matchup like this. Not that you want Tillman on Dame, but you don't want Cornette out there having to navigate that space. And I do think the Bucks would have tried to press that button and really take advantage of Cornette. So that's something to look at if the Celtics do match up against the Bucks in a postseason series. Cornette's going to be a big part of certain series. He's not going to be a big part of the Bucks series, would be my guess. That's what I'm guessing by what we saw in this game tonight. Oh, by the way, our SGP, thanks to our friends at FanDuel, we hit tonight. Celtics to win, boom. Tatum, 25, although he was at 23 for a while. You knew he was going to get there, but he got his 25. White with 4 assists, way over that. And White, 3 made 3. So we did hit the same game parlay. That was plus 267 if you tailed us on FanDuel. One other note, this is not Celtics related. So I'm watching that Bruins game, of course, on Tuesday night against the Senators. And Pasta is just awesome. He has the hat trick in that game. The first goal he had, the redirect off the Grizzly shot, just ridiculous. The skill level is just stupid. The second one, breakaway to the backhand. The third one, backhand off the feed from Shattenkirk. So he ends up with a hat trick in this game. It was crazy to just to see, like, he is just such a dangerous player. He just creates so much stress for the opponent. He's just awesome. I mean, it's just awesome to watch this guy play. Second last year with 61 goals. He is, what, up to 44 now, which is fourth entering play on Wednesday. He's fourth in points at 99. He was third last year at 113. So he's going to have back-to-back 50-goal seasons, and he's going to have back-to-back 100-point seasons. So we're just lucky that we have our winter teams right now, where they're just unbelievable. The Celtics and the Bruins. I mean, the Bruins aren't nearly at the level they were a year ago, but you have Tatum and Pasta. We talk about these issues that the other teams have, the Red Sox, the Bruins, right? And you look at these teams, they're just awesome, and they both have stars that you want to watch. Pasta is just unbelievably entertaining. Okay, one thing not Boston related. I'm sure a lot of you guys are following this and keep paying attention to it, because I think we're just going to get more and more twists and turns to this one. This Ohtani story that was broken by ESPN is out of control. So it's this whole gambling situation with Ohtani, apparently Ohtani's translator. So basically, to sum up the story, and you can read it, it's significantly long read for an article. But so Ohtani's rep goes on record saying that Ohtani transferred $4.5 million to a bookmaker on behalf of his interpreter. Okay, so Ohtani's interpreter tells ESPN Ohtani never bet and he paid off his debts because he felt he didn't want to just give the interpreter the money because he didn't trust him. So essentially the interpreter's saying, the interpreter's asked, why is Ohtani paying off the money and not just giving you the money to pay off? He says he doesn't trust him because he thinks he's going to gamble again, right? So then Ohtani's rep said, that Ohtani's part of a massive theft. This is after the interpreter says this to ESPN. Like, they had an interview with him on Tuesday. And then after that, Ohtani's rep said, no, he's actually part of a massive theft. After Ohtani's representatives had the interpreter talk to ESPN, is how I read the story. Then the interpreter says Ohtani had zero knowledge of this, says it's all his fault. And then ESPN asked him if he had legal counsel yet, and he said he's working on it. So this thing is crazy. First, we have Ohtani's interpreter saying Ohtani gave him, paid off his gambling debts $4.5 million. Ohtani's interpreter tells ESPN, oh, he didn't bet on baseball, nothing along these lines. It was soccer, it was college football, all these different things. But he said Ohtani paid off the debts directly because he didn't want to give the interpreter the money because the interpreter couldn't be trusted, according to the interpreter, because he was gambling all this money away. Then Ohtani's rep said, well, hold on. This is this massive theft against our client, against Ohtani. And then the interpreter then says Ohtani had no knowledge after saying that Ohtani paid off the debts. So who the hell knows what's going on right now? This just seems really fishy, okay? This seems really fishy right now, where why would the interpreter say Ohtani paid off the debts and then say all of a sudden he had no knowledge of the situation? So this is just insane right now. And it's going to be crazy to watch this story continue to go on, because essentially, too, part of this is the interpreter said that he used to bet with a legal service, but then they're in California, so he's using a bookie. There's this whole thing against the guy that's running that service. So it's just a wild story that I am incredibly interested in this one. It just seems like something right now does not, a lot of things right now do not pass the smell test with this story. Speaking of gambling, my buddy John Jastrzemski, JJ, and I, we're going to go through the tournament brackets right now. We'll give you our pick for each region and some things we really like in the first round of the tournament. So that's coming up next. Say goodbye to busted brackets, because FanDuel lets you bet on every game of the tourney. Whether you're betting on a big upset or a one seed, it's time to go dancing on America's number one sportsbook. Right now, new customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first $5 bet wins. So a couple of things I'm looking at. I like Texas Tech to cover the 4.5 against NC State. I also like Kentucky to cover 13.5 against Oakland. It's a big number, but Kentucky can really score. And going back to that Texas Tech-NC State game, everybody's in on NC State after they ran through the ACC. I do not believe in them whatsoever. That's $200 to use on point spreads, money lines. You can even pick who's going to win it all. And the wait is over, North Carolina. FanDuel is officially live in the Tar Heel State. Just visit FanDuel.com/Pike and bet on college hoops until they cut down the nets. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit TheRinger.com/RG. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. Joining us now from New York, New York, the Ringer Gambling Feed, East Coast Bias, part of the Wise Guys, of course, on FanDuel TV as well. It is my buddy JJ, John Jastrzemski. JJ, what's going on, man? How are you?
Barrett, it's good to see you, number one. Number two, I want to commend you. You did an outstanding job filling in on East Coast Bias while I was gone on my honeymoon over the last couple weeks. So I want to give you a round of applause for that publicly for your Boston, New England audience. The third thing I want to bring to your attention before you run some things off of me, I just finished up your Dynasty documentary on Apple TV. It was a part of my viewing as I was sitting down, diving in on the plane, needed something to watch. I enjoyed it. But my goodness, they made your head coach look like the most miserable prick on the planet. My God, did they paint Belichick in like the worst light imaginable? Did they not?
Yeah, well, I had the director on the pod every week, and one of the interesting things to me about it, because obviously Belichick, there's certain parts of the documentary that he comes off poorly in. The thing to me, though, about like the last couple of episodes, so episodes 9 and episode 10, I feel like Kraft wants to make Bill look bad, like what he's saying. Remember, he has this whole thing about talking about the 18 Super Bowl against the Rams, and he said, I was watching him because of what transpired the year prior. It's like, okay, you're watching the guy that's won 6 Super Bowls, right? They all blame the Malcolm Butler thing on him. Nobody else says anything about the reason for it except Kraft. Kraft says it's personal. Nobody else knows, but apparently Kraft said he put the he did not put the team first. And look, there's some certainly some truth to that. But also during this, he acts like a victim with the whole Brady situation, where he said, essentially, like, he's asked at the end of the documentary, do you think that Tom would have been here if Bill wasn't the coach? And he says, yes. You had a choice. You could have fired the coach and kept the player. Not to mention the other thing, and I was talking to the director about this as well, they didn't go into the contract with Brady. That was a big part of it. It wasn't like Belichick. It was just the personalities clashing. Certainly that's part of it. But Brady was never given the Drew Brees contract. And he had incentives in his contract that he was never going to reach in 2018. He said at a press conference, asked Mr. Kraft when he was asked about, should I get a contract extension? So to me, like, part of this, like, I thought Kraft came across awful in the documentary too. And I think he thinks he came across well by just like, he is so ungrateful for what Belichick did. I think part of this, JJ, is pretty simple. There's two main pieces, Bill and Tom. That's the reason the Patriots won all these Super Bowls. Kraft thinks he's just as important as those guys. That's what I think. And I think that, look, obviously, he wanted this documentary to be made. I think that Kraft thinks he's on the same level as those guys, which could not be close to the truth.
No doubt about it. And I almost think, in a way, it's kind of like a damage control documentary for what has transpired with the Patriots over the last 3 years, where, like, Kraft wants it. Hey, remember, before you roast me and say I can't run a football team, I want you guys to see, you know, the video montages and all the highlights of what happened when I had Tom and when I had Bill. But yeah, interesting stuff, dude. I wanted to throw that at you. That all being said, it was a very entertaining piece on Apple. I enjoyed it. Didn't make Bill look good. To your point, didn't make Kraft look particularly good. But Brady looked good. I'll say that. Tommy looked good.
I know. He certainly did. He's always going to look good, man. I mean, think about it. There was one question remaining with Brady. Could he do it without Bill? He answered that question in 8 months. I mean, it's just, the guy's amazing. But hey, JJ, so I have you on because obviously big on the gambling feed, big on FanDuel TV. So I wanted to, we don't get to talk a lot of college basketball on my pod. I mean, I know you do a lot more in New York. You got the Johnnies that should have been in the tournament. But anyway, I know a lot of bids got stolen in the final couple of weeks, but they definitely had a better case in my mind than a team like Virginia, who was just horrible in that game on Tuesday night. But I wanted to get some value here and look through these brackets with you. So let's start in the East region. UConn, number one in adjusted efficiency for KenPom, number one in offense. We know Dan Hurley is so incredible. They got the seven-footer. They got shooting. Castle has really come on for them down the stretch of the season, 6'6" that can lock guys up to. And you look at this, and FanDuel has them plus 105 to win the region, plus 105. Iowa State's plus 450. Auburn, who I really like, is at plus 450, but they're in UConn's region. Not to mention, this region is going to be played in Boston. They're going to, at the Garden, they're going to have a million fans. I look through the East region and look for some value anywhere other than UConn. I just can't see them coming out of this region. I know you say, oh, that's crazy. This is the tournament. Anything can happen. I just don't see it.
I totally understand that point. And trust me, I don't want to pick UConn to go to the Final Four. It's no fun. I like to be different. I'm sick and tired of UConn going on these runs. They last year were underseeded, kind of came out of nowhere, and waltzed to a national championship. They were not pushed, it felt like, in any of those particular games. But you hit on, from a value standpoint, where do we want to find value outside of UConn? So for anybody who's listening to the podcast right now and says, yeah, I'm sick of UConn, I don't want to bet them to go to the Final Four, who can I bet? You hit on the team, dude. Auburn. Look at their efficiency numbers. They right now in the KenPom are number four overall. They're 10th in offense. They're 4th in defense. They're a battle-tested team. They have a coach that's been there before. He's taken a team to the Final Four in Bruce Pearl. Now, the deck is stacked against them. The game is going to be in enemy territory. UConn is set up to go to the Final Four. In no way am I suggesting that UConn isn't going to get there. If somebody's going to knock them off, though, the pick I would make is Auburn in the Sweet 16. That's the way I see it. I think Auburn, if there's going to be somebody to do it, it's them.
Yeah, and they have the depth. That's a super deep team that Bruce Pearl has. That's why they beat Florida, is they're just, they have more depth than most other teams in the country right now. So in that first round in the East, the one game I'm looking at is the early game. Maybe it's just because it's early, JJ. I want to get involved. BYU versus Duquesne. Duquesne's hot, but BYU, they lost to a really good Texas Tech team in the Big 12 tournament. And 9.5 is a really big number. But BYU is second in made threes per game. Duquesne is at 7.6, which is 101st in the country. There's a big math problem there. And you look at BYU, 16th in overall adjusted efficiency, and they played in a really, really good league. JJ, of course, in the Big 12. I'm laying the 9.5 in that early game. Get some value on BYU. Is that too much for you, the 9.5?
Not at all. In fact, it's one of my favorite plays on Thursday and Friday. Think about it, Brian. Normally, when you have 6-11 matchups, the lines are very evenly matched. You're talking about a 2-point spread. You're talking about a 3-point spread. The Samford-Kansas line, as a perfect example, is at 7.5. This is a 6-11 matchup. BYU should not be a 6. The only reason they're a 6 is because the committee didn't want them playing Friday, Sunday, so they swapped them with Gonzaga, and they said, hey, we'll give you a little bit of an easier 11 seed. Well, that's exactly what they did, because Duquesne does not belong as an 11 seed. You mentioned a math problem. I'll mention a talent problem. I think Duquesne kind of got hot at the right time. BYU, battle-tested Big 12, good efficiency numbers, terrific offensive team. I feel comfortable. I endorse the pick, Brian. I love it. I'm laying 9.5 as well.
Yeah, is that they don't play, BYU doesn't want to play on Sundays for religious reasons? Is that why they do that?
Correct. Correct. Okay. That's why they're not playing Friday, Sunday. You know.
Well, that would make sense then with the seeding there. That makes total sense. I love that BYU pick. All right, so then you look at this West region. Arizona is actually plus 230 to win the region as the 2 seed. North Carolina is plus 340 on FanDuel. One team I think has a lot of value is New Mexico's plus 1700 if you want to look at a long shot here, right? They just won the Mountain West. They are 23rd in adjusted efficiency on KenPom. Jalen House, we're big fans here, JJ, because Eddie House, okay, we're pulling for Jalen House, who just went nuts in the Mountain West tournament. Jamal Mashburn's son's on that team as well, Jamal Mashburn Jr. And so UNC plus 340, that's some good value for the number one seed, obviously, as I mentioned. But I look at the East, like if some of those other teams from the East are in this region, like say Illinois or Auburn that we mentioned, I'd give them a chance. Even a team like Iowa State, I'm not crazy about, but I'd look at them. This West region, to me, it's kind of soft. I kind of like Baylor at plus 650, but they got to play New Mexico in the second round. This, to me, is just a really weird region. Where are you going with this one?
I'm glad that you mentioned New Mexico. It's one of my favorite plays for the round one. They're favored as an 11 seed against Clemson. They're going to win the game outright. That's number
2.5, yeah, I'm with you.
Number two, I think there's great value in them to get to the Final Four. Now, it's not my Final Four pick. I'm on UNC to get to the Final Four. I think the odds makers have this completely wrong. I don't understand how Arizona, with their tournament pedigree or lack thereof over the last few years, is favored to win this region. Plus, you throw in the wrinkle of Caleb Love, who, yes, had a terrific year for Arizona. I've seen him in the NCAA tournament. I've seen him throw up way too many clunkers. I don't trust him to play at a sustained level of excellence. I trust RJ Davis a heck of a lot more than I trust Caleb Love. So there's that. I have UNC and New Mexico, Barrett, playing in the Elite Eight. And if that happens, I'm going to be sitting pretty. So I'm with you. Eddie House's kid, Jamal Mashburn's kid, Patino Jr. coaching the team.
I know.
I'm on New Mexico. 17-1. Good number.
I'm going to go with Baylor to come out of there at plus 650. I've just been impressed with them throughout the season. I think Walters had like an up and down shooting season for them. He's a good player. They're an athletic team. I saw them give Houston all they could handle in a game a couple of weeks ago there where that game ended up going into overtime. They were a free throw away from winning that one. I'm going to go with Baylor at plus 650, although I hate the fact that the two teams I really like are Baylor and New Mexico, and they have to play in the round of 32, which I just don't like that. I'm with you, too. I like New Mexico to cover the 2.5 against Clemson. Clemson is completely overrated. I mean, they were bad down the stretch of the season. All right, so in the South, JJ, we have Houston at plus 135. Marquette at plus 550. Kolick, Shaka Smart says their point guard. He's going to play, but we don't know how healthy he's going to be. Duke is at plus 650. Kentucky plus 700. Florida plus 1600. The Gators, to me, an interesting long shot there. They did lose to Auburn. I mentioned that earlier in that title game, but I like them. I mean, they're 14th in offense. Todd Golden, I really like him as a coach. They run a lot of cool stuff. Houston, it's tough for me not to imagine them coming out of this region. I know they laid the egg in the Big 12 title game. Kentucky's a team that is just, their defense is so bad. They're 108th in the country. And one of the things that sticks out to me about them is just all the talent that John Calipari has had over the course of his career there at Kentucky. And he's got one national title. I mean, I think they'll do better in the tournament than they did in the, obviously, in some of those SEC games. But it's like, they'll outscore a lot of teams. I just, their defense is horrible. So I'm going to go with Houston to win that region. I'm going to take the one seed there. I'm taking the one seed in UConn. I'm taking the one seed in Houston. I'm taking the three in Baylor. Where are you going?
So I get your point about Kentucky. Kentucky's metrics stink defensively. And despite Shepherd and despite some of the great guards they bring to the table, it's hard to trust that they're going to be able to win multiple games in March playing that sort of defense. So I get your skepticism there. I do. I'm still taking them, though. I know it goes against every rule you have in the book, but I think their offense is that special and that good. It can get to a Final Four. I think Kentucky, Florida is where you find value. I like Florida, who played really well in the SEC tournament. I'm going to sprinkle both of them to get to the Final Four. My problem with Houston, they sometimes can really struggle to score. And if they get into one of those games where somebody is shooting the lights out and they really have to keep up, I wonder if that ends up being problematic for them. So I just don't want to give you all one seeds. Like, it's no fun. I get bored doing that, Brian. So I'll give you Kentucky and Florida as the two picks I like out of that region.
Yeah, one game I like. So I like that. I mean, that I like Florida more than I like Kentucky. I just don't trust Calipari. I mean, the guy, I still don't understand why. He recruits unbelievably well. I don't trust him. And I think that his two best guards come off the bench, which he did this years ago with Devin Booker coming off the bench. And they ended up going undefeated. And then they lost in the national title game, a game that they, or excuse me, in the Final Four, where they should have won the national championship that year. So one game I like, Texas Tech to cover 4.5, JJ, against NC State. Texas Tech right now, 23rd in offense, they're 45th in defense. NC State, they just played a huge tournament where they had to 5 games to get in. We know that Burns, not the smallest guy in the world, JJ. I feel like Texas Tech is going to blow them out. Correct me if I'm wrong. It looks like a lot of the money's coming in on NC State. Like, they lowered, I think that line originally was 5.5. It's down to 4.5.
I am right there with you with Texas Tech. I mean, we are lock and step in a lot of these. We've seen it with teams that win conference tournaments in miraculous fashion. Georgia Tech comes to mind. They lost in the first round. I know they didn't have Alvarado, but they lost in the first round. Georgetown is another one of those teams. They lost in the first round after winning the Big East tournament. Virginia Tech, they were in the same boat a few years ago. I'm very leery of teams like this. I think NC State played out of their minds for a week. The layoff, I think it's a come-to-Jesus moment. I'm with you. Texas Tech, lay it. Everyone, their mother is betting NC State, yet they're comfortable keeping this line in the 5, 5.5 range. Red Raiders win. They win by double digits.
I'm with you on that. It's just that NC State run, we may never see another run through a conference tournament like that, like a major conference. Like, that was, I still have no idea how NC State went through all these. Although, you know what? They should have lost to Virginia at the end of that game. I don't know. Well, maybe we do know what Tony Bennett was doing because he has not done a good job down the stretch of that season. But, all right, so Midwest region. Purdue is at plus 165. We've seen this before, JJ. I don't trust him. Tennessee is at plus 340. I don't trust Tennessee. I don't trust Rick Barnes, okay? And then you look at Creighton is at plus 460, which I really like. Gonzaga plus 850. Kansas is plus 1500. McCullough's out, so he's not going to play. And Dickinson has been banged up too. TCU kind of sneaky at plus 2,500. Creighton is fifth in threes per game. You have the 7-footer, of course, in Cockbrunner as well. I like them to come out of that region.
I love Creighton. Wow, we are on fire with these Barretts. So many family plays. You look at the efficiency numbers for Creighton. They're exactly what you're looking for. Top 25 offense, top 25 defense. We love that. I also love the fact that they were in the Elite Eight last year. So this is a team that's been in the NCAA tournament. They kind of know what they're getting themselves into. You know I'm not taking Purdue. You know I'm not taking Tennessee. I don't trust either one of their head coaches. I think the winner of Creighton and Oregon is going to the Final Four. How about that? The Creighton-Oregon winner, I will be investing in both. I think Oregon is a much different team. You know what it is with them? They're well-coached, and they're much healthier than what they were early in the year. They're a much healthier bunch now in January and February. I think Creighton wins the game, and I think Creighton is the Final Four pick. But the other one I'd give you is Oregon, because I think it's insane value. Insane.
That would be a nice game, too. Dana Altman Bowl there, where he's going up against Creighton, right? I mean, that would be fun to see. And by the way, Dana Altman's made it to a Final Four with Oregon in the past. A couple years ago, he made a deep run with that team. Okay, so I'm going to take a three-leg parlay, JJ. Tell me if you like this in that region. Samford to cover 7.5 against Kansas with no McCullough. I don't know what that team's going to look like. Creighton to beat Akron. TCU to beat Utah State. That's plus 213.
I definitely like it. And I think Kansas is there for the taking. They're not deep. They already lost one of their rotation players. Dickinson's beat up. And TCU, I think, is live. If they beat Utah State, they're live in that matchup against Purdue. They've been knocking at the door in that second round of 32 the last 2 years. TCU would be live against Purdue. Very live.
Okay. All right, so that's my parlay for the weekend. And obviously, we'll have to make some changes come Saturday and Sunday because I'm sure a lot of my picks will end up losing that I feel so confident in right now, JJ. But so I'm going with the 2-1 seeds, Houston and UConn, and then I'm going with 2-3 seeds in Baylor and Creighton. I got UConn winning the national title. I mean, I think this is one of the best teams we've seen in recent history. I think back, like, the second Villanova team was awfully impressive, the team that won with DiVincenzo, I think, was the most outstanding player of that Final Four, but they had Bridges, they had Jalen Brunson. So this is a really, really good UConn team. Like, the best team I think we've seen in college basketball in a couple of years.
Well, I hope you're wrong on that, because I'm so sick and tired of seeing UConn. So, you're right. They are a team that's poised to do something we haven't seen since Florida, but rooting like crazy against it, Brian Barrett. What can I tell you?
Hey, we'll always have the 6 overtime game, JJ, the Orange. All right, that is John Jastrzemski from New York, New York, the Ringer Gambling Feed, East Coast Bias, part of the Wise Guys on FanDuel TV as well. JJ, thanks so much for the time, man, and enjoy the tournament.
Anytime. Anything for you, Brian. Appreciate it, buddy. Take care.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over 2 decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. Great stuff there from JJ, John Jastrzemski. Always enjoy chatting with JJ, and he was watching the Dynasty as well as he laid out, but this is really, and we bring in now producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan. This is really the only time of the year that I'll really talk college hoops at all, right? I mean, we don't really have good teams around here. BC had a couple of good teams back in the day, and I think about back to that, like, Craig Smith team with Jared Dudley. Like, they had some interesting teams, but college basketball, I mean, it's just not as big here. I guess now with UConn, we have a lot of UConn fans in Massachusetts, and as I alluded to with JJ, having UConn at the Garden is just going to be absolutely nuts. I'm sure our buddy Andrew Callahan will be at that game, right? When UConn goes to, hopefully for him, clinches a Final Four bid. But I do really still enjoy the tournament. I still really do enjoy the tournament, Jamie, even if I'm not the biggest college basketball guy anymore. In the past 4, 5, 6 weeks, I've been watching a lot more college basketball because you have these Saturdays where it's just, there's basketball all day long. So I've enjoyed watching a lot of college hoops. And I do really like this UConn team. I stick by what I said with JJ. It's one of the better teams I've seen in recent college basketball history. Like, I'm not going back to the Duke teams in the 90s were awesome. UNLV, that team was awesome. The 2001 Duke team was incredible. You had Florida teams that won back-to-back, and you go all the way back to the UCLA teams. But in the one-and-done era, this is one of the better teams that I've seen, right? I mean, they have good young guys, good veterans. Dan Hurley's an outstanding coach. So I'm fired up for the tournament. And my Final Four, man, I really fought with it. I didn't want to go all ones. So I went with Houston. I went with UConn. I really like that Creighton team. And Baylor. I like Baylor. I was tempted to go New Mexico. Like, JJ and I were going through the value on that New Mexico team. I really like them, but That Baylor team is going to be tough to beat just because they're, and look, New Mexico can score like crazy. I went through some of the numbers, but Baylor is a really athletic team, and I could see Baylor making that run. And look, Drew's a guy that's been to a national championship and won before, so it's not like he's a bad tournament coach or anything along those lines going up against Rick Pitino's son. That's going to be an incredible second-round matchup in the round of 32.
Brian, you're going against the houses after all that talk. Can't give any love for New Mexico.
I did. I mean, I gave a tremendous value for them, and I really like them. I just, am I really going to pick New Mexico to make the Final Four? I mean, that value is incredible. You may just want to sprinkle some value on that, as I pointed out, but you think about New Mexico and Baylor in the second round, like, I'm almost pissed off it worked out that way because I really like both those teams, and New Mexico's an awesome team to root for, and I can't wait to see Eddie House. Did you see him during the Mountain West tournament? He had the jersey on.
No, I gotta look that up.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. He's got his kid's jersey on. But yeah, Jalen House in that tournament. He had a 28-point game. He had a 29-point game. Incredible. And that's plus 1,700. So it may be just worth sprinkling a little bit on New Mexico at plus 1,700 to see them come out of that West region. Like, that's the thing I hate about the tournament is this East region is loaded. And UConn's the best team. So it's like, okay, they probably don't give a shit that they're going to go up against all these really good teams. But then you look through it. And you're like, Auburn easily could have won a different bracket, different region, I should say. Iowa State just won the Big 12. They could win a different region, right? And instead, I don't know why all these good teams are in the East region. I mean, the committee already did a poor job putting Virginia in. Virginia had no business getting in the tournament. What, they have 14 points in the first half of that game on Tuesday. So they already screwed themselves. And look, there was a ton of bids stolen. Like, essentially, I think the final number ended up being 5 bids were stolen because all these teams that were not expected to win conference tournaments won. NC State won. Oregon won. JJ's high on Oregon. Oregon won, and he makes a good point. They had some injuries and whatnot. But all these different conferences, they had winners that nobody expected. So all these bids get stolen. So basically, like, by the time we arrive on Selection Sunday, there's no more bids to be given out. Like, all these bids have been stolen, which is remarkable. You'll have like one or two a year, right? That's why you have the bubble teams, because one or two bids get stolen. But like this, like, Indiana State doesn't get in. That's a team that a lot of people wanted to see. I mean, the kid's got the nickname Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Like, he's a goofy looking dude that can fill it up. They're not in it. They lost to Drake in their conference tournament. So yeah, we didn't get in because all these bids were stolen. But some of those Big East teams, like Seton Hall, didn't get in. St. John's didn't get in. These are teams that would have gotten into the tournament if it wasn't for, well, A, Virginia getting in. Any of those teams would have been more entertaining than what we saw from Virginia. But B, the other component to all this is all these bids got stolen. So that's the unfortunate part. But Thursday, Friday, man, two of my favorite days of the year. I will say this, though. My favorite round is the Sweet 16. I love the Sweet 16 because you have just enough games. Like, the Thursday and Friday, I love it. I enjoy it. It can be overwhelming, right? Like, my screen attention can be like 2 screens. I can't do like 3 or 4. Like, 3 or 4 is too much, but I can't wait, man. I'm going to be watching these games all day Thursday, all day Friday.
It's like the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. Like, you want just the right quality of matchups, but not too few. And not too many games. So I'm with you on the Sweet 16. That'll be fun. Quick gambling note, Brian, though. Enlighten me as someone out in California. Because there's a law back in Massachusetts that you can't bet on the home state teams. Does it matter that all these games are being played in the Garden, or is that fair game?
Oh, I think you can bet on them. I just think you can't bet on Massachusetts teams. Yeah, I hope that's the case, or nobody's going to be able to bet on the East region when it's here in Boston.
Well, we have, Brian, you got your UConn, which is New England's hometown team. I mean, they're kind of like the weird stepbrother, Connecticut. Like, they kind of count. But we got another hometown team. What about Yale? Yale and UConn could potentially meet.
I don't see UConn playing a game that's not double digits in their region. Heck, they may go the whole tournament without playing a game that's in single digits. I mean, they had a dominant run last year, and they're actually better this year. Now, I would say the field is better this year than it was last year, but don't... UConn is not my team, okay? They are not my team whatsoever. They are a rival of my team. And I told Callahan a couple of weeks ago, I don't hate UConn like I hate Georgetown and hate Nova, but I certainly don't want them to win it. I just think they're going to win it. Based on what we've seen this year, they've been by far the best team in the country all season long. All right, Jamie, before we go, you got your pick, you got your Final Four picks, you got your national championship pick. What are you looking at?
Look, Brian, I'm looking at fun teams that I haven't seen in the Final Four or the dance. So New Mexico, that sparks joy in my mind. So I'm going with them. Man, I get it. You got your Syracuse bias. My family from New Haven, Connecticut, repping Connecticut all day. So I'll go with the Huskies. That's all we got as New England NCAA fans. It's as close as I got to a hometown team.
All right, so you're going with the Huskies. I have the Huskies too, winning the national championship. I don't want them to win it, but I am going with UConn to win the national championship. All right, so I thought it'd be fun that we get into some college hoops. Most of you will be listening to this on Thursday morning as you're getting ready for the tournament. So hopefully you can use some of the picks that JJ and I gave out. Hopefully we'll win you some money in this tournament, not lose you any money. But hopefully you hear this, of course, before the festivities start on Thursday into Friday. Cannot wait for the tournament. We'll do a lot of Patriots on the next pod with Mark Daniels from Mass Live. We'll get into the Red Sox with Ann Kundle from SoxProspects.com. All right, as always, make sure to get your voicemails in at 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Schrute for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.